The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
I discovered there were three old men, octogenarians, living in the village who had been to the First World War, and got talking to one of them who told me he'd been to the First World War with Horses. He said, what you have to understand is that we were all 17, 18. We didn't know anything. We'd never met a German, but that's what we were all doing. And we didn't do it for the flag. We didn't even do it for the regiment. We did it for the people on the right and left of us. And we were all terrified, he says. We were all terrified.
We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields.
Before I could get to the shelter, two bombs had already dropped and blew me. My auntie screamed and she said that our front door was blown down.
If Great Britain goes down, all of us would be living at the point of a gun.
War doesn't just break buildings, it breaks lives. And Uncle Peter had been killed in the Second World War. He was in the RAF, Bomber Command, and died aged 21. And he looked like Rupert Brooke. He was a very beautiful man. He was an actor. He went to Rada. And I picked up on the grief and the sadness that my mother felt all her life. And it never went away, this loss of a brother that young.
Baghdad Cigar Aficionado Club always starts with a prayer for families, for hope, and then for the brethren. Later, there is silent recognition of the sudden explosion beyond our walls and the firefight flashes on the horizon. Overhead, the medevac helos always sound angry, especially at night, engines roaring a protest against the misery of their cargo as they fly to their grim sanctuary of hope with crewmen full of purpose and pity. At the Baghdad Cigar Aficionado Club, many wish the leaf they burn was the casual afterglow of those distant firefights. As the aromatic smoke drifts upward toward the rotor wash, laden with unspoken gratitude that they are in a safe camaraderie and the medevac crews are not for now mopping up their blood.
Some old favourites and some new voices there for this Remembrance weekend. Even for those who have no truck with the rituals of Remembrance Day, this one is a bit special. Not only will the 2 minute silence fall for the first time on the 11th of the 11th of the 11th, but it will also fall for the first time, so far as we know, outside living memory. For Michael Morpurgo, it all came together when he found himself writing War Horse way back in the early 1980s.
We know that roughly 10 million soldiers died on all sides, so that's probably 10 million horses. And the suffering they'd done together, the dying they'd done together, they would died in exactly the same way. It was disease, it was exhaustion, it was drowning in mud, it was torn by wire, it was blown apart by shells. All that happened to their flesh and our flesh. And it was from that that I decided that I would try to write a story of the universality of the suffering in that war. I didn't want to write from a British side or a German side or a French side or a Canadian side. I just thought, try and have a pair of eyes on this conflict, which listens to all sides, and the horse provided that. And so the horse became both the narrator and the great innocent victim, the witness of the horror that Sassoon went through, and Edward Thomas and Wilfred Owen, a different take on it, if you like.
Do you think it would have been as successful if it had focused on the human story rather than the horse story?
Well, I wrote another book, Private Peaceful, which does focus on the human story, and it's, I think as a book it's been more successful than War Horse until now. I think all the horse does is allows young people access to this horror, which they don't know much about. I mean, the First World War is taught in secondary school. Sometimes people have a vague notion of it. So it is history now. There's no one alive who really remembers it. So how do you evoke that? How do you go back? And you can do it certainly by having books, diaries written by soldiers who were there. You can certainly do it by visiting the place. I've been time and time again to Ypres, to Belgium or to France or whatever, to the battlefields, and you see kids coming over in coachloads. But it's just so huge. How do you get your head into something like that? Well, with the Holocaust, you know, thank God for Anne Frank. It's who witnessed the suffering. That's the one we care about.
We still refer to it as the Great War.
To me, it's, and I think to most of us, it's the metaphor for all wars, really. I mean, yes, it's the Great War, it's the First World War. But actually, of all the wars that we can think of, it was the most elementally stupid. When you go to a colonial war, you go to the Boer War, you can look back on it and, you know, with huge regret and that we were ever involved in such a war. We might say the same of Afghanistan today. But the First World War was this, it's as huge as the Trojan War. It's just powerful people, emperors, kings, politicians, resorting to violence in order to discover who's the most important European power. Goodness sakes, they're all related. The Germans are all related to us in the royal family. It's unbelievable stuff. It was simply pride, who wants to be top nation. And we've battered ourselves into, into where we are now. A massive amount of strength was bled out of Europe at that time. Before the Second World War ever came along and finished the job, the First World War started it. So of all the wars, when you have men in their millions lined up, digging holes in the ground, and then these hopeless series of attacks which went on 4 or 5 years, whatever it was, getting up and running into barbed wire, running into machine gun fire, and, you know, tens of thousands being killed in a day. It's the madness of war carried to an extreme.
Now, apart from the human story, there is underlying the story of War Horse, the huge technological change, which meant that at the beginning of the war, war horses were central to fighting, and by the end of it, they were pretty much redundant.
Yeah.
How much do you think that has resonance in this age of very, very quick change?
With the perspective of history, we can look back at 1914, at the moment when cavalry charged into machine guns, hopelessly, uselessly, and people realised it wasn't going to work, that this big fist of military strategy, the cavalry, was useless. So horses were fine for pulling guns, they were fine for pulling ambulances and that sort of thing. But as a, if you like, a weapon of war, a powerful weapon of war, people could see the writing on the wall. Many people in the cavalry couldn't see it. But yes, there was a moment, wasn't there, when we introduced the tank. And why did we introduce the tank? Because the other thing wasn't working. We needed a big, heavy fist, iron fist, to knock through the enemy wire and to push things on. As it happened, it was only a half-hearted effort. We didn't wait till the technology was right before we did it. But nonetheless, it was the beginning of this. And everyone knew then this was the moment that the horse really wasn't much use to us anymore for that. And funnily enough, of course, it happened pretty soon after the war that was so also on the land.
There's one other point, which is that it was the war in which was written down by ordinary people.
Yeah.
For the first time on a mass scale.
Yes.
And so we have war poetry, which still resonates with us hugely. How much do you think that is what's kept it? And we're obviously at a time when we've got lots of more wars going and lots more soldiers are writing poetry. Mm.
The literature of the First World War, the poetry of the First World War, I think uniquely in this country, in terms of its extraordinary power and reach, it was the first time, I think, that it really resonated, poetry resonated with a huge swathe of the population. And it's not an accident, but interestingly, and it is interesting, I think, most of that, not all of it, but most of it was written by officers. quite an English thing, the whole business of education and class being very connected, as it was then and to some extent still is now. I think what's happened since is that poetry has reached out of a class and into the people. People respond to it now. If a soldier is writing powerfully, personally, about what has happened to him or her in Afghanistan, it's very telling. It's very telling when people write what they mean, you know? And I've always noticed that with children. If you look kids in the eye when you're reading them a story and they know you mean it, that's when a story or a poem really works well. And so to me, that's made a huge contribution to our understanding of November the 11th. It reaches way beyond the First World War. We know that the wars we've had since have been the one we're involved in at the moment. There's just huge question marks, but what I think is never questioned is that people who go out and do this in our name, even if the cause is not one we can support, what we can respect enormously is the fact that they stuck to their guns, is the word, and they stood there. And it's that standing there and doing it is extraordinary. And when you think of the young lives lost, particularly, I think, funnily enough, in lost causes, you know, the tragedy is immense. And if I can be political, and I see no reason why we shouldn't be, because every war is political, what we're doing in Afghanistan is that every time an Afghan civilian is killed, it simply increases the amount of bitterness and anger there's going to be. And I have no doubt at all that we reap the reward of these things. And that's what's sad, is you sort of know that these young men, they're doing their duty, they're doing all they can in our name, but it's not solving anything. And the First World War didn't either.
They were summoned from the hillside, they were called in from the glen, and the country found them ready at the stirring call for men. Keep the home fires burning while your hearts are yearning, though your lands are far away.
Michael Morpurgo. As he wryly remarked, he's become the conscience of the Great War for the great-great-grandchildren of those who served in it. Here in the studio is another writer who's done a lot to keep the memories alive, Andrew Motion. As well as republishing his own poetry sequence about the war, Laurels and Donkeys, he's written an introduction for an anthology by largely amateur poets, most of them soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you.
With us too is Louisa Young, whose most recent novel, My Dear, I Wanted to Tell You, is also set in the First World War. And among the stories it tells is of the birth of maxillofacial surgery, that is to reconstruct the faces of the men who did make it back, but often with hideously disfiguring facial injuries.
Hello.
Welcome, Louisa. Louisa, I have to fess up here that the first I knew about your novel was when it was shortlisted for the Wellcome Prize for Medicine and Literature, and I assumed it was about the Second World War, because that's what we all know about facial surgery.
Yes, of course, we all go automatically to the Guinea Pig Club, whereas in fact the Guinea Pig Club was run by the nephew of the great pioneering facial plastic surgeon, Major Harold Gillies, who I came across because my grandmother, who was a sculptor, Kathleen Scott, worked with him casting the faces of these poor wounded boys who were being rebuilt and healed, and terrible long time it took. So these artists, including Tonks, who did pastel portraits of the various stages of their treatment, and Kathleen would be there making casts and clay models. So when I wrote her biography, I came across some photographs and drawings of these boys, and that was my first book. And I looked at them and I just thought, when I'm a good enough writer, I'm going to come back and try and do something for them. It's quite extraordinary what they were doing.
You clearly are a good enough writer in that you've been longlisted alongside Philip Roth for this prize. Was that a surprise to you? Not longlisted, in fact, shortlisted.
Shortlisted. What I'm really delighted about is that I just won a Galaxy and then the Wellcome alongside Philip Roth, so I feel I must be doing something right to be scoring at both ends of the array.
Okay, well, we'll come back to you a little bit later. Now, Andrew, as poet laureate, the rituals of public memory presumably weighed quite heavily on you.
The one which was always most interesting to me, because it connected very intimately with family matters, things that are bound to sort of trigger a more directly emotional response, was to do with commemorating a war or wars in general. Because my grandfather fought in the First World War and because my father had fought in the Second World War, I didn't talk very much to my grandfather about this business. But towards the end of my father's life, I talked to him about it a lot because he suddenly sort of changed in his willingness to recall it. And I think a lot of people are familiar with the idea that men, in particular perhaps of that generation, though Louise, you may have something interesting to say to contradict this, but my sense of it is that men in particular of my father's generation, born in the early 1920s, found it, for all kinds of complicated reasons, very difficult to talk about their experience in the war. No doubt one of those reasons was that they didn't want to let its shadow fall into the lives of their children. That's what I felt about my dad, anyway. But when I had children of my own, my father was somehow liberated by this and began to talk about it. And in fact, on the 60th anniversary of the D-Day landings, in which my father had taken part, I went back to France with him, and we sort of tramped around in the places that he'd been in. It was one of the most moving times of my life, I must say.
Maupogo made the point that the soldiers writing the First World War were officer class, and that what's happened since then is it's opened up to the other ranks.
Yes, I think there's a very important conversation to have about the demographic of all this, if one can put it like that. It's not quite true to say that all the best-known First World War poets were officers.
Rosenberg wasn't,
and neither was David Jones. The majority of the ones that we want to go back and read and reread, Owen, Sassoon, Graves, Edward Thomas, as we notice that they were all officers, we also immediately, I think, want to say that they have their success as writers, their genius as writers, depends on them overstepping precisely those sorts of boundaries of sympathy that you might expect, or ignorance even, that you might expect to prevail. I mean, personally, I don't feel a great difference. It's there, but I don't feel it's a great difference between the kind of boots-level observation that Rosenberg and Graves are able to make and what you find in a characteristic poem by Wilfred Owen.
You're here partly as the introducer of Enduring Freedom, an Afghan anthology, which includes Edmund Blunden is in it, as well as serving officers from today.
That's right. I mean, I didn't have very much to do with the actual design of the contents, but I was very pleased to be asked to write the introduction to it because it extends the question that you've just put, which is what happens to war poetry as the demographic of the army changes. I mean, in the First World War, because virtually everybody ends up being involved in it somehow or other, you're bound to catch a few people who are going to be poets anyway. With a much smaller army, and an army of which the social definition is perhaps narrower now, there's no guarantee that you're simply going to sweep up somebody who's going to be a poet anyway. And yet, the evidence suggests that a lot of the guys who do go out and fight feel drawn towards poetry as a way of expressing themselves about a subject which in all sorts of respects must be incredibly difficult. So a lot of the traditional expectations that poetry carries and the opportunities it offers suddenly become available to them, and that can be very moving. It can also mean, I think one should immediately say that, I mean, if you come across a work of genius, fantastic, but actually, by and large, you're looking for quality, but something else as well, which is to do with authenticity of response, I think.
Now, there's a second book that's also out this Armistice Day called Heroes, 100 Poems from the New Generation of War Poets, and that this is actually all serving soldiers, and it shows one of the sort of slightly poignant things, that they're actually not very good poets, most of them.
That's right, and that's really what I mean. I mean, one could say that in an unkind way, and I absolutely don't mean to, and neither do you. But it is a way of noticing the background point that I was making, which is that it tells us certain things about schooling, about reading, about the kind of educational opportunities that a lot of these boys have had before they joined the army, and indeed since joining the army. So it's not really surprising to see some of those things made manifest in the way that they're writing. Mm-hmm. And if you do read the anthology looking for works of genius, on most of the pages you're going to be a bit disappointed, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But equally, you're going to be rewarded by the sense that they really know what they're talking about because they were there. You can't take anything away from that.
Now, one of the poets you have included in Enduring Freedom is the mother of a serving soldier. That's very interesting because, Louisa, most of the war poets are male, aren't they? It's a very male genre.
Well, on the one hand, it has to be, because certainly until recently they were the ones doing the blood and guts. And it's also, I think, back to this thing you were saying about the quality and not meaning to be unkind, but it's much easier for women, and there were women poets, certainly in the First World War. Women, I learned unexpectedly that there were 530-something published women poets.
During the First World War period.
Now, a fair number of them were VADs and they had their experiences, but the male experiences were bound to be much more various, and there were a great many more soldiers than there were nurses. And there were an awful lot of women sitting at home who didn't know very much and who were, you know, steeped in Victorian traditions of often, let's face it, rather sentimental and not very good. So on the one hand, you have the emotional authenticity, but when you come down to things like Jesse Pope and sort of who's for the trenches, laddie are you, and that sort of, you know, all over the Daily Mail, it's not necessarily what one most wants. But then you get these very touching, again, not necessarily very good poems by women who are better known for other forms of writing. Because when you look at those female poets, the ones who are well known tend to be people like Vera Brittain or Edith Bagnold or Eleanor Fargen and so on, who have written memoirs and they've written novels. And, of course, they also wrote poetry because that's what that kind of lady did.
So let's go to one of them who you've mentioned, Eleanor Fargen. Andrew, I didn't know this poem, but I was introduced to it by Michael Mopurgo, who discovered it in your anthology of the poems of the Great War, First World War Poems, it's called, and it was published back in 2003. And he was particularly interested in it because he loved the juxtaposition. So can you tell us the context of this poem? It's called Easter Monday. Can you just explain the context of this poem?
Yes. Eleanor Fargen was a very dear friend of Edward Thomas's. She was in love with him, but they didn't ever have anything like an affair. Thomas was married to Helen and stayed faithful to Helen all his life, so far as we can tell. But when Thomas died, he was killed at the Battle of Arras in 1917, on Easter Monday 1917, which is why the poem's called that. She quite soon after that set off into writing a memoir of him and about the last 4 years of his life, which were the years in which she best knew him. Very tender book, very sweet. But like this poem, which has an extraordinarily plain last line, very vigilant too. I mean, she is a very interesting writer.
In the last letter that I had from France, you thanked me for the silver Easter egg, which I had hidden in the box of apples you'd like to munch beyond all other fruit. You found the egg the Monday before Easter and said, "I will praise Easter Monday now. It was such a lovely morning." Then you spoke of the coming battle and said, "This is the eve. Goodbye. And may I have a letter soon?" That Easter Monday was a day for praise. It was such a lovely morning. In our garden, we sowed our earliest seeds, and in the orchard, the apple bud was ripe. It was the eve. There are three letters that you will not get.
Oh, it sends shivers down your spine. Louisa, there are three letters that you will not get.
Reminds me of my to bring things back to my grandmother, who is married to Captain Scott of the Antarctic, and the letters that she sent to him across and that he didn't get, and the letters that she got from him after he was dead. And you think that must have been going on all the time, declarations and so on. And what you were saying earlier about, you know, the fathers not wanting to talk about the war, that's one reason why I chose the title for my novel, which was taken from a field postcard, i.e. various ones for different purposes. This was one for the wounded soldiers, which goes, "My dear blank, fill in as appropriate, I wanted to tell you that I have received a slight, serious, delete as appropriate, wound in my blank." And the whole setup of my novel was, who's going to tell the truth? They're sitting there in the casualty clearing station. Write to your mother, "I've had my leg blown off." Certainly not. "I've received a slight wound in my stiff upper lip."
Indeed.
"And we're not going to be talking about it." And, you know, what you want to tell people, what you can't tell them, you know, and particularly facial injuries where you literally can't talk to people.
Indeed.
And all that, it's you know.
That's very rich.
But that line, that last line is...
It's chilling, isn't it? Now, I would like to move on to another point that Michael Mopurgo made, which is about the importance of technological change as part of the First World War and its continuing resonance with us, particularly now that we're at another period of intense, very accelerated technological change. And this is very relevant to your book, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we all know there are so many things that we can't write now because, you know, we can't use the diaries and the letters and the telegrams as devices for showing things from different points of views. And, you know, you can't say there are, you know, three Skype calls that, you know, I'm going to be carrying around in my handbag forever, because if things don't happen, they don't happen. It's so immediate. And it affects creatively as well because, you know, when you look at the poets in particular, like everything else at that time, it went from Victorian to modern within 5 years, levels of progress which should have taken much longer. And what they were writing about as well at the same time was increasing. You know, you start out with cavalry and bayonets, and by the end you've got the tanks are working properly and you've got the aeroplanes and bombardment. It's like, vroom. And people have to deal with that emotionally and physically.
Andrew, we're talking about changes in information technology as well as hardware, aren't we?
Sure.
Will soldiers be writing poetry in 10 years' time, or will they all just be tweeting?
They'll be writing poems. I mean, they may be tweeting their poems, but they'll still be writing poems. Poetry is very, very primitive. We might happen to grow up to speak a quite complicated language about it and even to write quite complicated poems. But if we ever forget that it is a very fundamental human thing, like sounds, rhythms, language at the point where making sense meets a language that is not precisely concerned to make sense in the way that a newspaper article makes sense. I mean, those are absolutely basic things to the human being, so it will always be there. I mean, just quickly to dart back to what you were saying a minute ago, Louise, about mechanical developments of one kind or another. I've often thought that a very sort of neat, perhaps too neat, way of thinking about the difference for soldiers, at least between the First and the Second, and by extension between the Second and subsequent wars, is to think of Wilfred Owen saying, in Strange Meeting, "I parried, but my hands were loath and cold," which allows us to think about hand-to-hand fighting. And then to think about a poem by the great Second World War poet Keith Douglas, who's not nearly well known enough, saying in one of his poems, "Now in my dial of glass appears the soldier who is going to die." And you have right there that sense of separation from your enemy, which, I don't know, I've never had to do it, thank God, but I mean, does it make killing somebody easier? I mean, is it easy to fly an aeroplane over a landscape where you can't see a single human being and drop your bum and know that you've killed thousands of people?
Well, of course, Daniel Swift last year wrote a book called Bomber County,
in which
he explored the idea that actually bombers never wrote poetry because they were on surgical strikes, really. They were the surgical strikes, weren't they? They were industrial. They didn't have that relationship with their quarry or whatever.
I mean, I think that's a very interesting possibility. It doesn't quite convince me. I mean, I'd like to think if I was flying an aeroplane, I might want to write a poem about the subject would be that you don't see what you're doing, but you know it's happening.
Let's just move on yet again to the book that you would recommend. If somebody wants to pick up one book about the First World War, since it is Remembrance Sunday, what would you read?
Well, the best new book that I've read in which the war figures large is by Wade Davis, and it's called Into the Silence, published by Bodley Head. The Great War, or the First World War, and Mallory, George Mallory, the mountaineer, and the conquest of Everest. And it talks about the roots of their mountaineering aspirations, as well as their actual achievements as mountaineers, and how those roots lie in their first-hand experience, or their, as it were, acquired experience of the Great War. And even though, if you're interested in this subject, you're likely to have read, as I have done, probably by now, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books about the First World War and the level of suffering that was involved and the brutalities and so on, I don't think, again, within my memory, I've read anything which shocked me so much as those accounts did. It's written with an extraordinary kind of address and a feel for its barbarity that is really hair-raising. And then it allows you to think that these differently incredibly brave men who clambered up mountain faces that hadn't been clambered up before were both daring themselves. They were experiencing a form of survivor guilt, actually, of course. But they were also entering, and this is very interestingly true for Mallory, entering a realm which is in some sense pure. It's beyond the human race. Nobody's been there before. It's a way of escaping, at least briefly, except of course he didn't because he died out there, escaping the kind of ghastly nightmare echo of the war that was going on in all their minds.
This must have been true of your great-grandfather, was it, or your grandfather?
Well, my ancestor I was thinking of, I've got one for every occasion, was my great-uncle, who lost a leg during the war. There were three brothers. One lost his arm, that was my grandfather. One lost his leg. The other, they said, lost his mind, because he came back a communist. But the one who lost his leg, Geoffrey Winthrop Young, was a mountaineer and apparently climbed the Matterhorn, the wrong side, taking his spare wooden leg with him for the photograph.
He's mentioned in this book, you must read
I want to. I'd like to find out the truth about him as opposed to family legends.
Whether it was actually his second best wooden leg or his first best wooden
leg. I never believe anything my family tells me for just that sort of reason.
Well, we could go on talking forever, but I want you to recommend your book for this.
Yes, I will go back to an old one, Paul Fussell's The Great War in Modern Memory, which is this terribly interesting about those images and symbols which we all recognise so, I mean, they're so clear, and particularly the First War and the Vietnam War, you know, you just have to say, for the First War, you know, poppy, silhouette, shell hole with sunset, you know, men swimming naked in a river, all these things which are so utterly familiar from everything and sometimes used so brilliantly, and yet they're clichés and yet we love them. And this book takes you completely through the what and the why and the how and whether it's true and how it's been used and all the undercurrents, and it's completely fascinating, completely, from a historical point of view, as a historian and as a writer. It's just wonderful.
It is, it's a wonderful book.
Thank you very much. If you want more details of those two books or of the books by our contributors today, you can go to guardian.co.uk/books. Louisa's My Dear, I Wanted to Tell You is published by HarperCollins. Enduring Freedom, an Afghan anthology, is published by Firestep Press. And Andrew's Laurels and Donkeys is also just out and is going to be on the radio this weekend. We'll end with Andrew, if you would, reading a poem from that collection.
I will. Since we've been talking about relations a bit, I'll read one about me and my dad. I'm about to make the structure of the poem sound rather complicated, which actually it isn't, but what it does is to alternate between scenes in which I remember being a little boy, sitting around the kitchen table with my mum, cleaning the shinable bits of my father's uniform, and a trip to Poland that I made in the early 1980s, because after my father had landed on Normandy, in Normandy, his regiment veered off a bit towards the Polish border and something rather grim happened, which gets alluded to here. So, kitchen table, train in Poland, kitchen table, train in Poland. That's the structure of it. It's called Now Then. It was not my war, but all the same, my father handed over the harness of his Sam Brown for me to polish, and his enormous boots. There was no way I could ever make the toes brighter than they were already. Years later, I was riding a train south from Gdansk to Warsaw at 0400 hours. The pine forest swarmed beside me, lit sometimes by devilish icy sparks which flew from our wheels at points, always by the softer glow of carriages. "Tell him about the smell," my mother said, working hard on his buttons with Brasso at the window end of the kitchen table. She meant the smell of Belsen, the first my father had known of any such place. He only shook his head. "I don't think so." The forest lasted for miles, miles and miles. Then for a second I saw deep into the heart of a clearing. There was this swineherd lolling against the wall of his pine cabin, wearing the helmet of a German soldier, and pigs rootling in the husky moonlight. "Why not?" my mother continued her polishing. "Surely the boy is old enough to know history." My father sighed. "Now then, you know the reason." That ended it. I kept my eyes down and attention fixed on the long face looming in his toe caps, convinced my efforts would never pass muster. Eventually I slept, dreaming through what remained of the great pine forest of Europe, with my father pounding along in the dark outside my carriage. At Warsaw, he fell away from me, but not before passing his boots through the window and asking, would I mind giving them a last quick once over?
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.